Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, three awesome PC cases, a couple of SSDs, a gorgeous $5,000 PC, Mew meets Mimo, free NAS builds, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 281, recorded August 21st, 2014. Big kitty, small cases. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most exciting, most thrilling, and most engaging news in computer technology. We love the hardware mostly. We love the computers mostly in terms of full-on Windows and OS X desktops. We love Linux. Today, we love FreeSB. Tomorrow, we'll love the world. But mostly, we're going to love smartphones and tablets because eventually that's all we're going to be able to game on. Right, Malventano?
Probably.
And yes, joining me today, Mr. Alan Malventano, freshly moved to beautiful, beautiful Kentucky. Formerly of the United States Navy, currently of PC Per, and you are swollen with SSD reviews today.
Just a little bit, yeah. There's still another stack to go, but yeah, that's what we got done for now.
It's kind of frightening to think about. Should we talk about NVIDIA? So people from NVIDIA are coming by PC Per tomorrow to do a live Q&A with Ryan. What's going on
Tom
there?
Peterson. Tom Peterson's in town. He's already in town, actually.
Cool.
And they're going to do a, let's see, the hint Ryan gave everybody yesterday on the podcast was it will involve threes of things.
Threes. Three GPUs? Three monitors?
Maybe.
Three cats?
No. No, not the cats.
Apparently, ladies and gentlemen, you're going to have to tune in to PCPer.com on Friday, August 22nd at noon Eastern Standard, I assume?
Noon Eastern, yes.
Noon Eastern. Or just tune in later when they've got the video posted after the event, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. But if you do a live stream, like there are going to be giveaways, I imagine.
Ooh.
Usually there is that sort of thing. Might be worth coming to check out.
Stay at PC Per until they're done. I am still wrapping my head around the idea that AMD is doing a Radeon R7 branded series of SSDs. You just got hands-on with the 480 gigabyte version. How do you feel about it? Is this a good place for AMD to be, or is it a peculiar place for AMD to be?
It is peculiar to me. And I say that because like I test a lot of SSDs, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I get their point, right? AMD, why would they want to do something like this? Well, they've already started doing RAM, right? They've been doing that for a while now. They partnered with a few vendors, you know, years ago and mm-hmm. started making like gaming memory. And then they even bundled like a RAM disk package from another company, right? They kind of made a little deal with them, partnered up with them, put their name on that piece of software so they can have like up to a 6 gigabyte RAM disk if you have enough RAM to make a 6 gigabyte RAM disk and still have room for everything else. So all that was all cool. So they've already got, you know, they've covered CPUs. Now they're covering GPUs. They got RAM. So like, I'm sure at some point they were like, what do we do next? And someone probably just said, oh, let's do an SSD. So they partnered with OCZ. And it's not that OCZ really put a brand new controller in this. I mean, they have a very capable Barefoot 3 controller that, you know, third iteration of the IndieLynx controller. It's a good controller. But the thing is, it's really not very segmented. Like, there was a warranty gap between the Vertex and the Vector from OCZ. So you had like 3-year warranty, 5-year warranty. And so AMD was just kind of like, all right, 4-year warranty. So they just like kind of nestled it right between those two. So it's using the M00 version of the Barefoot, which is actually overclocked version of it, which is in the Vector, right? So the non-overclocked version of that is in the Vertex. Kind of gets a little confusing there.
A little.
Right. So you have, you know, overclocked on one side, not overclocked on the other. So AMD, of course, is using the overclocked version, right? So they're basically borrowing the controller variant from the highest end of the Barefoot 3, which is the Vector. And they're, you know, they're packaging it with this new A19 nanometer. And I'm actually saying A, it doesn't mean asynchronous. It's like a advanced 19 nanometer flash from Toshiba, which is just a newer version of 19 nanometer flash from them. That flash is already in the Arc, which is another barefoot controlled OCZ SSD. So now you've got four different products all with the same controller. And as you might imagine, the performance difference between all of them is not super large, right? It's, mm-hmm. you know, roughly the same kind of flash, same kind of controller. Yeah, the clock speed of the controller is a little bit different. But when you look at all four of them, they're very, very similar. So then you kind of get down to, all right, well, let's look at price. And unfortunately, the Arc performs very similarly to the R7, and the Arc might have a little bit less warranty. All right, mm-hmm. it's like a slightly shorter warranty period, rated for less writes per day than the R7 is. Right. But the R7 is like 20, 25% more expensive. So, I mean, I really want to like it. I want to like the idea of it a lot. But as it is right now, you have the R7, which is kind of a little bit on the pricey side, compared to the Arc, which was granted very low cost per gig for OCZ, but still kind of pricey compared to, like, you know, 840 Evos that are on sale right now for 39 cents a gig, right?
Right.
That kind of thing, right? So 50 cents a gig for the Arc, this is kind of not really competing when you have people just trying to go, well, I can have a terabyte for $380 if I get this Samsung drive right now, which I never thought I'd say for an SSD, like a terabyte for, you know, less than $400.
Terabyte for $12.
Well, that would be nice.
I'm exaggerating, but I mean, it really is.
Yeah.
The idea of parity between SSDs used to be a pipe dream. And now it's like, wait a minute, we're a couple years out here. And obviously they're going to figure out how to make, you know, rotating media much, much larger over the next couple of years. But at least as they do what they've been doing for the last 25 years. But it's kind of amazing to realize that, hey, a terabyte's kind of almost in the neighborhood of affordable. I like that.
Yeah. It's that kind of thing. So that's what, and actually Ryan and I were talking about this. Actually, this applies to both SSDs that we're going to talk about here, is that people trying to enter the market with a new model or a new SKU of something else, it's really hard right now, right? You have to, you can't just come in and undercut the competition when the margins have to be razor thin at this point to be able to do a terabyte for less than $400 from some vendors, right? So it kind of puts a bad mark on almost anybody trying to launch an SSD now, right? Because that's what you have to compare with. And if, you know, there's a lot of people out there that are just looking for cost per gig. Like, you know, you do have people looking for performance, right? But on that point, the R7 is actually priced almost like to the dollar the same as the Vector, which has 1 year more warranty and uses the same exact controller and has the same specs, et cetera, et cetera. So
essentially, it's nice they need to cut the price. It's nice
that the price really needs to come down. If the price comes down to like somewhere closer to the Arc, or maybe even lower than the Arc, or maybe they bundle it with some games or do some kind of AMD-ish kind of thing with it, that will make me start talking about it in like an excited form. But at this point, I'm like, it's pricey, you know?
Pricey is not good for this market right now.
Yes, not good right now.
Not good. Well, let's talk about what's going on with the Angel Bird SSD. The Angel Bird SSD, WRK, 512 gigabytes. And, you know, you kind of open the article with the line that first hit me as soon as I saw the title. You might have never heard of Angel Bird until now, that is. So, I could try to speak German, but Austria.
I can't say it either.
Vorarlberg, Austria. But it's like, European SSD maker breaking into the US market. Lovely design. I got to say, I like the little wing logo.
The design is really cool. The logo's cool. The design itself is cool. That is probably the first SSD enclosure I've seen that's complete wraparound, like it's an extruded aluminum housing. There's no seams in the housing. It opens up kind of like the older, a few generations back, iPod Nanos used to, where it was plastic on the top and bottom and aluminum wrapped around. And you had to slide the whole thing out one end of it, right? That's how you take this SSD apart. So the first time we'd looked at Silicon Motion, so I believe it's the 2246 EN controller, pretty sure was the model, the part number. They actually launched a brand new controller at Flash Memory Summit, but we haven't looked at one of those yet. But this is the one that's been shipping for a while. And that controller actually looks pretty strong in the reads, like sequential reads, it was able to saturate SATA even more than we thought SATA was previously being saturated. Like, it's able to get like another 10 meg per second over the next fastest thing.
Wow.
Which, yeah, like we thought, you know, it's like 520, 530, like that sort of thing. That should be just be like as high as you could possibly go, right? And other SSDs were like a little bit shy of it. In the IO meter stuff, it was kind of towards, it wasn't really screaming. But you have to remember that all of our workloads for IO meter, it throws in some writes. And I think the writes were kind of holding it back a little bit. And combined with just that controller on random IO isn't really super fast. But in a straight line, it's like a dragster, like read speed. Like if I had some specific application for an SSD where I needed the absolute fastest possible sequential reads for something with absolutely no hiccups whatsoever, I would go with Silicon Motion, even over pretty much anything else, believe it or not. But again, we got to get down to price, right? So on most of the benchmarks that are like trace-based benchmarks, like typical user kind of benchmarks, this SSD was kind of pretty much on par with everything else at this point, because they're really kind of all hitting a glass ceiling at this point as far as SATA SSDs, right? We really do need to move to PCI Express to have groundbreaking performance improvements over what everybody's making on SATA now. So if you get it down to price, the price is on this SSD very similar to the R7. So, you know, you kind of still stuck in that rut, right? Where should I get this or should I get something that's in some cases even nearly half the price, right? Because the lowest capacity model of this guy was almost 80 cents a gig. And you have, think about it, you could potentially buy a twice the capacity SSD from someone else for the same price, right? Someone else selling a 40 cent per gig SSD. You know, you throw in a couple more bucks and you have that SSD, right? So yeah, and then the other kind of double whammy here was that the way that the flash memory layout for this one and even for the R7 is the write speeds taper off kind of drastically starting below 480. So the SSDs we've been looking at lately from like Marvell controllers and like Samsung controllers, like they have really high die counts relative to the capacity of each die. So the more dies you have, the more parallel writing you can do inside the SSD, and that means the faster write speed you get. Those Marvell and Samsung and the other guys have been doing that. Meanwhile, these are still using like the 128 gigabit dies, which are relatively large capacity per die. So that means that the die count falls off enough once they get to 256 gig, where their write speed's already dropped to like 350, as opposed to like high fours or low fives, right? And then you get to 128 gig, and the write speeds drop to like 150 or 200, right? So that's not the capacities we tested, but even on their own specs, like the IOs per second and like the random write performance and the sequential write performance really falls off sharply. So you have two SSDs with really sharp write falloffs and kind of high cost per gigs, especially at the lower capacities. So it's, I don't know. If you're going to get it, either one of these, you really got to be going for the half a terabyte model. And you really have to want it.
So basically, the SSD market has officially gotten vicious.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's like
when Intel walks away because the margins aren't there, Samsung basically owns everything. And what Samsung doesn't own is like, you know, Toshiba rebranding OCZ and then a few other markets.
It's getting to the point where, you know, yeah, I mean, Angelbird, the quality's really good on the Angelbird products. Don't get me wrong on that, right? The build quality, the case is not like nothing we've ever seen. Looks really good. But then again, you have to be a person that wants to buy an SSD for how it looks, which is not that many people, I would imagine, right? If you're doing a specific kind of case build, you want something to look really awesome, sure, go for that. But apart from that...
Know what you're getting into.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of getting into exciting new things and maybe paying a bit more, Ken's got to write up a PC Pro, the Main Gear Pulse 17 gaming notebook review. And kind of the story here is kind of a two-stage story. It's a 17-inch gaming laptop. It's got pretty badass performance compared to some of the other boutique gaming laptops that they've reviewed on PC Pro recently. But scroll down past the big orange box, a little bit farther down, Burke. And the kind of story is right there. Top Main Gear Pulse 17, bottom Asus G750JX. There it is. And you notice something? Yep. The Main Gear Pulse 17 is a lot thinner, and that's pretty much the story right here. It's, you know, it's pretty crazy. So in that skinny little orange box there is an Intel Core i7-4700HQ, an NVIDIA GTX 765M GPU. Apparently it now ships with an 870M. 1 terabyte hard drive, 2 120 gigabyte MSATA SSDs in Super RAID 0, so you can have all of the reliability issues of RAID and all of the speed, or somewhat more speed than you have with a single MSATA drive. I'm sorry, was that rude? I still remember it's the early days.
It's only Death Wish RAID if it's hard drives, really. Generally speaking,
yeah. SSDs are safe.
The PC I'm sitting at is for a quad SSD RAID 0, and it's, you know, I do back it up. Don't get me wrong. If you're going to run a RAID 0, you better be backing it up. But I would say that four decent SSDs, like four known reliable SSDs, are way more reliable long-term than a single hard drive even.
Yeah, I will not argue with you on that. I will not argue anything with you on storage. But although I think quad SSDs in the desktop is a little extreme. But it's a good-looking laptop, backlit keyboard, all the kind of eye candy features you would expect. But that thinness, that relative thinness, and we should put this into context, right? So that black notebook we showed earlier at the bottom is an Asus G750JX, which weighs at about 10 pounds and is about 2 inches thick. Right. And you get a significant weight reduction and obviously a significant depth or thickness reduction when you're going to that Main Gear Pulse 17. But where you are picking up is the tab, and you're looking at about $2,100 for comparable performance. Considerably lower amount of mass for you to carry. It's still a lunch tray that you have to carry around with you with that big old 17-inch screen. But it's an interesting-looking machine, and Ken's got a good write-up on that at PCPer.com.
Yep, he had to lug that thing around for a few weeks.
Oh, that would be a lot of laptop to carry around. If you're looking for new cases, this is the week for you on PC Per. The Corsair Carbide Air 240 Micro ATX case review is up. And this is, I don't know if Michael and I were there, or if it was Ryan and Michael and I in the Corsair. It must have been Michael and I in the Corsair suite at CES. And this was the case that everybody looked at and walked away from and walked back to and walked away from and walked back to and walked away from. It's gorgeous. So there's a full video tour of that. Giant window on the side. So if you're not a giant window on the side fan, this is not your case. And it's an unusual layout. If you go to the shot from the back, you're going to see where the – essentially it's a big, fat – short case, right? So the motherboard is about 4 inches behind that motherboard there, where you're basically burying the power supply and other things in a separate thermal area from the motherboard and the GPUs and stuff. These really nice slots to drop your hard drives into. It's a really sweet layout. Micro ATX form factors fit right in there.
It gives you just that whole compartment on the back end that you can basically stuff all your wires, your power supply, and all your hard drives and all the cabling associated with them. Right. So you could do three and a half inch and 3 2.5 inch cages. Just has them all laid out right there. And three seems kind of an interesting number, but you know, it's a good number, right? I personally would probably like four, of course, but you know, or like 8 or 16 or something, but I'm crazy.
To match your SSDs. Well, yeah, what's crazy about it, it's gonna be shipping early September. That's an $89 case. Right. Mini ITX or micro ATX, but it's a really, it's unlike most of the mini or micro ATX designs. It's designed to stuff a whole lot of hardware in there along with it.
If you don't mind the case being, if you don't mind it being a little bit wider, but in turn, like much shorter and much shallower of a case, right? Mm-hmm. You have to, as long as you're okay with a little bit of width, like it really just kills the overall size of the case. Like it's just tiny looking, and it's, the pictures don't even really do it justice. It's seeing it in person, especially next to like its older, bigger brother. Like the thing is just tiny. Yeah.
It does look tiny by comparison. If you're looking for something even smaller, a more traditional, little tiny case, Cooler Master Elite 110. Lee took a look at this. Lee looked at the Cooler Master Elite 110. And then this is, Jeremy's got this write up. And they basically looked at it again, 8.2 inches by 10.3 inches by 11.1 inches. It's stuffed. You know, it's like putting together you know, some sort of children's toy. But once you have everything packed in there, it takes up no space. And you also can only fit a 3-inch heat sink inside of that, Jeremy notes. But yeah, it's funny. They're linking to a Tech Report article that basically says choose your components carefully if you actually want to not be able to hear this thing throughout the entire house. But it's $40 and it's really small. And it's really, really densely packed once you get everything inside of that.
Yep, they had to extend the power supply out the back a little bit. Like the part that holds the power supply actually extends out like an inch and a half, I think. Yeah.
That's pretty crazy.
Yep. They had to do trickery.
Now, so did Lee review the CM half stacker 935 mod tower at the offices?
No. He does all that stuff out where he's at, which is, I think it's... He was north of us. Like, he's close, I think. I should probably meet him someday. I haven't met him yet.
Well, anyway, we've looked at a couple of small cases, and this is, to say the opposite, is kind of an understatement.
We saw a few of these at QuakeCon, actually. One guy had... So, basically, what this is just, you know, you have what looks like a regular size, well, kind of on the large end case that you can have, like, your regular desktop-looking case, right? But they also make these smaller cases that's basically as if you took the desktop case and just chopped it in half. So it's the same depth and the same width, but like half the height. And and the idea is that the half height, there's a couple of different versions of that. And one of the versions, well, maybe both, but at least one of them is designed to be able to have all the components in that. Right. Wow. So imagine just a regular kind of tower case, but just chopped in half and everything would have to fit there, right? So it makes, you know, it makes for interesting things, but the more interesting combination is that there's grommets on the bottom of all of these things and there's ways to run wires out the top. So, and they can stack on top of each other, hence the stacker name. so you can, you know, so you can take like the regular tower case and you can stick another module, like a half height module on top of that, and just have that be nothing but your cooling, like your full of radiators and, you know, water cooling stuff, right? And just have all your heat sinks and water box and stuff just down in the main case below without kind of complicating issues. Or there's another version of that module that has like 9 hard drive bays in it. So you just
That's
stick
the
that
one
module
that,
on
that
top
I'm
of it.
Obsessed with.
I would have liked to see that module like with just them going all the way across, like with no gaps whatsoever. But again, you know, I'm crazy. You know, but you can, but it's interesting combinations, right? You can stack however you want to. You can stack these things. Like there's really no limit. You can just make a system with like 3.5, I think, stacked, or just, you know, any combination of the larger version and the smaller versions on top or below. So yeah, I mean, it's a pretty cool. Pretty cool idea. And actually, there's so many different combinations and so many different things to talk about with it that I think that's the first time Lee's done an article where it's part one.
Wow.
So, like, he has more to do.
It's a little frightening. So, what is the, actually, I take it back. There it is, the pricing. So, the half stacker, the mod tower case is $170. And then the mini ITX cases, the module cases are like $70 and $60.
Yeah.
So, that's
not
bad.
You know, if you consider how much of a beast of a case that is, I mean, you're getting, it's like you're buying multiple cases, really, and they could be used individually. So even in the future, you know, if you took that system apart, you could theoretically just break down those cases and put a system in each part of them, right?
And it would be interesting to see that we had a comment in the chat room that was like, I wish there was case innovation, and hopefully the stacker is considered to be case innovation, because it actually is a, I don't think I've seen anything like that. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that.
They were at CES in all sorts of different colors and stuff like that. And then at QuakeCon, there was one guy that had one of those half-height versions on top of his build, and all it had was like some water cooling stuff. But then since there's empty space in there, just air space between the fans and like the water coolers, he actually had like a couple of camshafts from like a Honda engine just rotating slowly just to be part of his build, just a cool thing to look at. And I was, you know, I'm a car guy, so I'm like, oh wow, camshafts,
it looks like, so shiny.
Yeah, so there's the Burke's point out, the grommets on the bottom.
Nice.
So it pretty much lets
and
you
filters
run whatever
on
you
all
want.
The fan slots, removable external filters on the fan slots. I'm a big
yes cleanable You know, because
Brother
if you
Phoenix
have three
is
of those
a future
stacked,
case.
Oops, yeah, if I have three of those stacked together, I probably want to be able to remove and clean the air filters as opposed to trying to lug that whole thing out to my garage to blow it out with air.
Not to mention the fact that if you slip or yank on any part of that, you're going to be ripping SATA cables out of your motherboard.
I think they connect together somehow. Like, I think they screw together or something to hold them together. Something like that.
We wait with bated breath. Should you be in the market for a slightly smaller case with a slightly larger price that includes all of the goodies, you are going to want to be, well, just Tim Berry's got the write up a piece of Falcon Northwest Tiki Z Special Edition. This thing's ridiculous and it's really pretty. This is a classic boutique system, beautiful paint, lots of options, and all of the money. A Titan Z, a liquid cooled i7-4790K in a micro tower. This is what the Titan Z, or the Titan, I should say, was invented for. lots of computing power in a little tiny case where it could show off how quiet it was.
But it's a Titan Z, which is so expensive.
Yeah, so literally, so this is a $5,614 system with a 600-watt power supply. And if I'm not mistaken, so it's 13 inches high, 4 inches wide, and I think is $3,000 of that price the GPU?
It is. Yeah. That's a $3,000 GPU, which, cool. You know, I think if you're going to pay that much, you might as well showcase it in that.
Yeah.
Right.
The exterior of the case. The exterior of the case can be painted in any single color of automobile paint for free or with a fully customized paint scheme with artwork at an additional cost. So. We should point out the Titan Z, 5,760 CUDA cores, 12 gigs of memory, 8.1 teraflops of peak compute power. I just love
that
the fact
that it's a gorgeous system, though. Like,
yeah,
that is just,
it absolutely is.
Yeah.
And relatively silent and available now. And to sweeten the deal for a limited time, Falcon Northwest is including a free Asus PB287Q 4K monitor with each Tiki Z purchase. So there you have
also,
it.
Also known as, please take our Titan Zs. We're just trying to sell them.
Well, that's a 60 hertz 4K monitor for $650. So,
well, we were talking about this on the podcast where you can get, I think Origin is selling, doing a deal where you're getting a 4K display and a Titan Z and a system. Granted, it's not a real high-end system, but an entire rest of a computer, right, for $4,000 or less than $4,000. So if we were doing that math on the podcast because it was confusing us because we're like, wait a minute, Titan Z is 3K. The 4K panel is like $700. That only is $300 for the whole rest of the computer? And it, you know, it's like, where is this coming from? And the only thing we can conclude is that they're probably starting to mark down the Titan Zs because I think they're realizing nobody wants to buy them for $3,000. Because it's kind of high-end for a video card. Just kind of. Just a little.
No. That's kind of high-end. Like, you know, you're kind of impregnant or you're kind of in jail or you kind of melted your processor. Kind of.
Yeah. Almost every vehicle I've purchased in my entire lifetime has been cheaper than that.
The last five systems I've built combined will still leave me enough to buy a used car.
Yeah.
Rather than buying that. Well, okay. So let's talk about is it Mu MIMO or Micro MIMO technology in the Asus RT?
It is multi-user MIMO. Even though MIMO is kind of already implying multiplexing and talking to multiple things at the same time, right? Some, you know, multiple in, multiple out kind of thing. Anyway, so yes, there's an Asus router that is insanely beefy looking. Like, if you look at the thing, it just looks like a tank and has quad antennas. And,
well, this looks like Batman's router is what it looks like.
Right, which is hilarious because the previous three-antenna Asus router was called like the Dark Knight router.
Yes.
And now you follow it up with this thing. Like, this thing's just going to eat Batman's lunch, right? Like, it's just like, give me your lunch money, kid. It's, you know, it's like just insane. And it draws something like 40-something watts, I think. Yeah.
That's a lot of electricity for a router these days.
Yeah. So what it's doing, though, is they employed different like radios from different vendors. So usually you have your typical Wi-Fi router and it has just a radio set in it, and that handles like the AC and the N, and it handles the 2.4 gigahertz and the 5 gigahertz, right? So they put, I think they're kind of getting, like, we don't have an absolute answer on this, but I think they're kind of getting away with saying it's multi-user version of MIMO, because they have two completely different like radio stacks in the thing. So it's able to talk to somebody on 2.4 gigahertz at the same time that the other radio set inside of it is talking to someone over 5 gigahertz, right? Because usually the radio would have to jump like hop frequencies, right? Because the, you know, the radio can only do one thing at a time physically, right?
So it basically can speak to an 802.11n client and an 802.11 3x3 11ac client simultaneously.
Yeah, simultaneously, and have like reads from one and writes to the other, or, you know, upload, download, whatever you want to call it, like at the same time. And usually you can't do that, right? Because if you're, especially if your radios are connected to the same three antennas, right? Mm-hmm. If one was transmitting and the other one was trying to listen, you know, it's like you're trying to listen to someone while someone's blowing a, you know, bullhorn in your ear, right? Or an air horn or something. Like, you know, you're just, you overload the receiver, right? So usually you can't do that. And that's probably part of the reason this one has the quad antennas, so that you can have, you know, one radio be like, all right, I'll talk to this guy on these, on these pair of antennas. You let me use these other pair of antennas, that sort of thing, right? Yeah. So, I mean, it looks really cool and everything. I'm kind of skeptical right now because it's two different kinds of radios, and we're not sure how, like, the open source support is for that. Like, I'm the kind of person that doesn't buy a router unless I know I can put either Tomato or DDWare or some other firmware.
But it
on
has
there.
Asus WRT on it.
it does, and the Asus firmware is actually pretty good. There's just like a few features that I like using. That's, you know, just me personally, and I think that people that are already in the open source firmware ecosystem, I don't think they buy another router unless what they're used to can be installed on it. Like, I think that's just kind of, you know.
Oh, I've been playing with a couple of $200-$250 routers, and testing them is kind of a wicked ripping pain for any of a number of reasons. But the thing that keeps striking me is that, you know, the clients are a bigger issue at this point, or the receiver built into
the radios in whatever the mobile device is.
Yeah, whether it's, you know, your phone or your laptop or the, you know, Wi-Fi that's built into your desktop, or that you add on to your desktop to make this happen. I mean, it's
even in their own picture, you'll notice they're using, for their AC client, they're showing the Asus NIC that has 3x3 antennas, and that NIC is like, I think, over $100. It's up there.
It's not cheap.
I mean, don't get me wrong. There are some laptops that do it. Like Macs, believe it or not, tend to be really good about that. They usually have like the highest end radio available at the time. Right.
So if I know you people have say Macs Mac, pricey. It's perfect.
Well, yeah, but even like the older ones are still like 2x2, like decent radio, like, you know, 5 gigahertz, where you didn't have 5 gigahertz before, right? I mean, you can still buy current Windows machines that will usually come with just 2.4 gig. Like, that's the tendency, right? Whereas some other manufacturers will do nothing but, like, you know, the really fast throughput wireless stuff. Stuff you didn't think you need until you actually are trying to move big files around your network from sitting on your couch, you know. And then everything changes in an instant. You're like, this file transfer is going to take 7 hours? What?
There is
tomorrow
life
morning
beyond Netflix streaming.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Let's take a moment. Sorry, I opened up the Asus PC DIY blog and I'm looking at more pictures of the death router, the bat death router of doom, Batman's router from heck. Let's try to keep it family friendly. We should take a moment to take some questions because we got you on the show. Twitch@twit.tv is the email address. It was funny. One of the first questions I posted up on Twitter two of them were at Balt Matrix asks, any ideas of fun things to do with 6 hard disk drives of different terabyte sizes, a ZFS NAS maybe?
So, You can use storage spaces, believe it or not, and mix and match capacities and still have redundancy and stuff, right? Things that like a regular RAID card wouldn't do. There's also other ways to do that. There's a couple of solutions out there. Why are the names escaping me right now? But there's a few software packages that will give you a virtual drive letter, and they will address individual drives that can be individually formatted, like individual NTFS formatted hard drives. But it'll kind of gobble them all up into one drive letter, and you can set like on a folder level, I want this folder to be dual redundancy, and it'll actually put the files on two separate drives, right? Kind of like behind the scenes, which is how like Windows Media Center used to, or Windows, what was it, the Media Server OS? What was the name of that thing?
Windows
Remember that thing that they discontinued?
Server? No, the one they discontinued.
Windows Home Server. Windows Home Server, right, that they ended up discontinuing. It had some form of that kind of an idea, right, where the files themselves are distributed among volumes. So there's some ways to do that. I'm kind of a fan of storage spaces. It did some weird things when it first came out, but I think they've kind of fixed most of those.
I used a Windows 8 box, like a beta Windows 8 box, as a home server with a lot of media on it for, I think, the better part of a year with zero hitches on storage spaces, which made me really happy with it.
Well, storage spaces, and especially REFS instead of NTFS on there, it's just, as long as you're okay letting Windows be the thing that's determining your reliability of your data, and handling like the error recovery and stuff like that. Like that is extremely robust. Like I would really say that like if you're losing data on that, it's probably some really crazy hardware fault that you have, right? Because anything that when you go to run check disk on it, it says you do not need to run check disk on this. Because that's what REFS does. Like that's just for a good laugh, try to run check disk on REFS. It's like, no, it actually Jedi hand waves you and says, no, I don't need to run that. Like, I know what I'm doing. I got this, right?
We're good.
Yeah.
Not a problem.
Yeah, like I'm really close to, I am figuring out what I'm going to install or how I'm going to handle the storage network that I'm about to set up at this house, which is going to be a crap load of hard drives installed hidden inside of an arcade cabinet in the basement. So more to follow on that when I figure out like what I did, but it might actually be storage spaces and REFS, believe it or not.
It's a good idea because it's funny. The more we got to do, we did a big, like our first episode of Dytrium was building a free NAS box with ZFS enabled, and we got a lot of pushback. Ironically, from another former member of the submarine service that really beat me with a stick because we didn't recommend using ECC RAM. And the more you get into it, there's kind of a real split, right? So FreeNAS is this really amazing DIY operating system. And I bring this up because at News Media Fan tweets, at Patrick Norton, at Malvin Tano, do you have a minimum spec recommendation for a FreeNAS build? Principal uses file storage. And so if you are a hardcore FreeNAS builder, you want ECC, right, to make sure everything is super awesome and perfect and amazing. You probably want to use new hard drives. WD Reds would be a really good idea. And you want at least a gigabyte of memory per terabyte of RAM, and you probably want 8 gigabytes of memory. Because FreeNAS, when it starts doing its magic, or ZFS, I should say, the file system, when it starts doing its magic to protect files in FreeNAS, it's really cool, really sophisticated, and really, really compute intensive. There's probably, and I think I just managed to paste the same thing 4 times in the doc, and I'd like to apologize to Burke publicly for that. The point is, though, is, you know, you're looking like ideally you'd want like a, you know, a moderate, you know, quad core CPU, 8 gigabytes of RAM, and at that point, like 8 terabytes of drive, and you want to spread it across more drives, and then it gets really complicated. So we did a wonderful interview with one of the founders, sort of the driving lights behind FreeBSD, the guy that basically ran OS X development for a long time at the core, and who's part of IX Systems that builds FreeNAS now. We did a big Dytrium with him, which I really recommend if you want to learn a lot about the nitty-gritty of how it works. But take a look at the FreeNAS.org docs. They've got a really good collection of hardware recommendations. you know, 64-bit hardware is recommended. A 32-bit system can only address up to 4 gigs of RAM, which means it's not going to be able to deal very well with ZFS. You know, if you have access to a 32-bit system, use the UFS instead of ZFS file systems. And the thing that they hammer on over and over again, quote, the best way to get the most out of your FreeNAS system is to install as much RAM as possible. You know, FreeNAS with ZFS requires a minimum of 8 gigabytes of RAM. If you're thinking to yourself, like, I want to build a box, I don't worry about it. I'm not so worried if it crashes, I got some old hardware. That's a much better place to do a NAS for free build. But yeah, 5 gigabytes of RAM per terabyte of storage if you're doing ZFS deduplication, but I don't think anybody is going to be doing that in the normal world. If your system supports it and your budget allows for it, installs ECC RAM. If you want Active Directory running on your FreeNAS box, you need another 2 gigabytes of RAM.
So if you want Active Directory and you want to stay on the Windows side and not use the storage spaces thing, actually Marsworm in the chat, he nailed the name of what I was looking for earlier. It's a stable bit drive pool. Mm-hmm. So really cool idea, right? Everything is NTFS formatted individually, right? So say everything just goes to crap for some reason. You have no idea why. Something got corrupted somewhere. You can't get the RAID to work, or what is supposedly the RAID, right? That's really a crazy recovery if you're using something that's proprietary, whereas this just puts the files individually on all the drives. And like, not only that, but if you're one of those people that I imagine this happens to a lot, like you have all this, your system got full and you took an external drive and you stuck a bunch of stuff on it and then you put it on a shelf, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Or you just have like 5 external drives hanging off your system and they all just have one copy of whatever, right? If you finally get to the point where you want to build something just to be your storage system, right? You don't have to build the array with additional space. In other words, you don't have to, like, if you had a RAID before, or if you had stuff on individual drives and you wanted to build a RAID, you need to have all the drives free in order to set it up, right? You have to have a set of drives that are empty. With something like this, there's documented ways that they kind of built this around that flexibility where, you know, you set up your system, you set up your stable bit drive pool thing with just like one drive, right? Or a couple of drives, right? Even drives that had information already on them, since it can accept an already formatted drive. And it won't delete what's already on the drive. It'll just make a hidden folder. And inside the hidden folder is where it puts the stuff from the pool. It's where it puts the stuff on each drive. And the documented method that's really cool is that you fire up the pool, and then you have that drive had 1 terabyte of files on it. Like one of your drives had 1 terabyte of files on it. Well, you go in there, and you move all of that stuff directly into the hidden folder structure where it's where StableBit is storing its stuff. And then you tell the software, hey, I want you to like resynchronize and see what's out there. And it will find all that stuff and then proceed to, if you told it to mirror twice, it'll start in the background making an additional copy on one of the other drives, right? And you could do that with, like, you could have a dozen hard drives all full of stuff, right? Or relatively full of stuff. And you could do this process to each one of those, move everything into the hidden folder on all of them and tell it to resync. And it will see everything and it'll put it all under just one drive letter in Windows, right? And then, you know, you can add, if you want redundancy, you're going to obviously add some hard drives to have an extra copy, have a place to put an extra copy of everything. But once you have that extra space available, it'll just do it, right? It's kind of like what a Drobo does. But it does it without anything proprietary, really.
And for $20.
And it's like, yeah, it's like $20, right? It's a pretty good idea. It's I am toying with it.
And suddenly I want to look up the price of WD Reds.
see, it's dangerous.
I would
recommend Reds even for this. But you can get away with greens for something like this because it's not accessing it through a RAID controller that has any kind of a stringent timeout, right? It's just regular Windows, which does not time out after like 7 seconds.
It's just regular Windows.
It's regular Windows. Well, RAID controllers do that for good reason because you don't want the RAID controller to just hang everything for like, you know, a minute or two while it tries to read your file, right? Windows, you know, if it does that with one drive, okay, right? You're not going to, you know, you're not doing mission critical RAID enterprise web server, whatever stuff, right? You're at your house.
We should also point out, like, building a free NAS box is not a complete backup solution, right? I don't usually use the word solution because it's kind of been tainted with marketing mayhem, you know, but 3-2-1 is a backup solution. Three copies on two different medias, at least one off site, right? So, you know, if you use BitTorrent Sync to communicate to another machine somewhere else, or CrashPlan for free, you can back yourself up to a system somewhere else. If you use, you know, but free NAS boxes and allow them to communicate with each other.
Yeah. Be careful with the sync, right? Because that's, yes, it's a backup. Yes, it's in a different place. Right. But before you hit that sync, first of all, you shouldn't do automatic sync unless you know really what you're doing, right? Otherwise, you know, you accidentally deleted something in one place. You forgot you did it for a couple of days. The change synced across.
Yeah.
Now it's gone everywhere, right?
Well, which brings us back to, so you should be using something like CrashPlan if you're going to automate your backups, where it actually keeps multiple copies. Oh my goodness. We got a couple more questions. At Willie Manager, should I defrag either schedule or manual a SSHD drive?
Ooh, okay. Yes. Because it's still a hard drive.
Right.
Okay. I'm kind of treading on thin ice by saying that because you are potentially going to put some wear on the flash, on the cache itself, by doing the defrag. Okay. Right. The drive is going to actually kind of fight you. Right? Because you know, you're trying to move stuff around and whatnot. But SSHDs on the back end will put that stuff where you told it to go, even if it passes through the cache intermittently, right? So those writes, like the first few seconds of that defrag might run really, really quick because the cache actually cached the writes, and then the rest of the defrag will go slow, and it'll probably try to use that cache during the defrag. But in the end, all of those fragmented files that were physically fragmented, like location-wise on the hard disk part of that SSHD, will be put in the right place, right? So then what will happen is, moving forward, when you go to access stuff that's not in the cache, it will read quicker than it did before, right? Because the hard drive part will have been defragmented. Now, I wouldn't do this nearly as often as you would do with like regular hard drive. Regular hard drives, you could probably just get away with the default Windows scheduled thing, you know, assuming you leave your system on overnight for it to be able to actually do the defrag. SSHDs, nowhere near as much, right? Because for the most part, SSHDs are going to try to cache the stuff that would have been slow on the hard drive in the first place, right? Things that it sees are random access, it's going to try to put in the cache, right? So if you're kind of like really heavy gamer and you keep bouncing between three or four very large games, when your games are like, you know, to the point where they're much larger than like say 8 gig, because 8 gig is usually the size of a cache on an SSHD. Ryan and I actually did some tests and we were able to, like, just by running one game, like one really big game, a couple times, that was actually on our Seagate desktop SSHD review. We reviewed the 4 terabyte desktop SSHD, which is just a really big version of the laptop version of it. But again, same small cache, right? Only 8 gig cache. So we fired up, like, I think it was Battlefield a few times. And that was enough to completely purge all of the Windows information out of that cache.
Oops.
So the next time we went to reboot, so we went to reboot the system and we lost our really fast reboot time, right? Now, if you rebooted a few times without launching the big game, of course that was snappy again, but then the game was slow the next time you ran that, right? So it's SSHDs, like the cache is not big enough. This totally doesn't apply to if you're doing something like Intel Rapid Storage Technology, or you know, the other name that they keep using on it, but basically Intel's version of like motherboard hybrid caching.
Right.
If you're doing that, you can still run that defrag. It does the same kind of thing, but there's even less of a reason to do it in that case because you have a much larger cache, right? You're using an actual full SSD, like up to 60 gig worth to be your cache, which is much better.
I should reassure one more time, Opian in the chat room, who was for a minute there a little frightened because he thought he meant defrag SSD. And no, we do not defrag SSDs. We love to defrag hard drives. I'm the biggest, maybe not on OS X, but on Windows, I still regularly defrag, and I regularly see things just get happier on my system after I do that.
But on a hybrid, just don't do it too often.
Occasionally. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Nitty in the chat room says, are there any good free SSD benchmarkers out there to monitor the read-write fall-off? That's kind of an interesting question.
Okay, so the problem with this... Wow, this is such a hard thing to monitor. Because the only way to really know what the fall-off is to completely write, like read all the way across and write all the way across the drive. Okay? Because if you run a bunch of a particular benchmark in a row, you will actually cause the write speed of the SSD to slow down, right? Because you're fragmenting stuff, right? Where just you using Windows was tending to do, you know, it does all sorts of size writes, but the smaller size writes are the really bad ones, right? Well, benchmarks like to use really small writes. So you're hitting the SSD with a lot smaller stuff than it's used to seeing just in daily use. And that actually slows it down. If you do a benchmark that just does sequentials, now you actually have just clean slated the whole thing and you made it speed back up. So it's a Schrodinger's cat problem, right? It's like, you know, is this SSD slow or fast? Well, let's find out. I'll run this test. Said it was slow. Oh, guess what? Now that I've run the test, it's fast.
Friendly Manapoba posts in the chat room. Newegg got Samsung's 840 Evo 1 TB for $342 on eBay. It's $380, and you have to enter a coupon code to get it down to $342.
$342.
For Holy one crap. Terabyte SSD. Yeah, that was pretty much my reaction.
34 cents a gig.
34. It's nothing, people. Oh, my goodness.
That's really just like, yeah. And the other thing is, and everybody is pretty much assuming that Samsung is going to come out with an 850 Evo. Hasn't happened yet. But Samsung did announce at the Flash Memory Summit, first of all, there was an 850 Pro, which was about a month or two back. Then at the Flash Memory Summit, Samsung said they're going to take that same vertical NAND, that 32-layer VNAND, and make it triple-level cell, as well as multi-level cell, which is what the 850 Pro is. So that only leaves one step remaining, which is just to build an 850 Evo, right? Once they do that, I'm hoping that the 850 Evo prices are going to be, I'm hoping they can get them to the same, like, right away. Like, I would hope to see sale prices of, like, 40 cents a gig for that. And that would make it super phenomenal because that is an extremely fast SSD. And it's the same controller that was in the 840. So it's not like they made some vast improvement to the controller itself. It's because the flash is so dang fast. Right? I mean, think about it. Architecturally, you're reading from whole columns, right? Vertical flash memory columns. And when you go to write to it, you're not worried about writing one bit interfering with the bit next to it or the bit next to it because they're all on this extremely close, like as tight as you can pack it together, just one plane, right? The 3D stuff, there's a lot more space between those bits. So on the writes, they don't have to do like a write and then check to make sure all the voltages are good and then write a little more. If they had to nudge it in the right way. That's actually what SSDs do, right? It's actually when you do writes, the reason writes are so much slower than reads is because it's actually doing like a write and a read and like another little bit of a write and maybe another read and maybe even another write. It's actually a loop until all the bits are like where it wants them, right?
And then your head explodes.
Yeah. Yeah. But it does it much less so with the VNAND stuff and the cells are just bigger. Right, they can store the bits for longer. They can store the electrons for longer without stuff leaking. If you lose 3 electrons, you didn't just change a bit like on the linear, the planar stuff that has very, very small cells at this point.
That is a frightening thought.
Well, I like the idea of the vertical stuff. Like all the companies are probably going to do it at some point. It's just Samsung is already on their second generation of it.
Yeah,
well, so...
They have all the research or maybe the longer research.
Yep.
Oh my goodness. So what's coming up on PC Pro this week? Obviously, the NVIDIA interview Q&A live video session with free stuff being given away. Should you be lucky enough to hear this podcast before noon Eastern on August 22nd, you should definitely tune into that.
You should definitely. Those are always really good when we do live streams. Like we've had AMD on, we've had NVIDIA on. Anytime we do any of those, we do... Like we have people talking back to the chat. I mean, think about it. You have like one of the top people at a given company on our live stream. Like you might as well ask her questions. If there's ever a time to get it answered, you want to go through the fewest people possible to get there. That's the time, right?
That's a good thing.
Yep. Oh, and I mean, Tom Peterson is usually, he doesn't really hold back unless he's like definitely not supposed to say something. You pretty much will speak. You know, he pretty much will speak his mind. So he's one of the good guys to have on. Yeah.
It's a good thing. Oh, my goodness. I'm going through the joy of benchmarking USB 3.0 thumb drives just out of curiosity. Remind me never to do that again.
Yeah, you should. That's painful.
It's consistently painful. And I'm reviewing my first Windows phone, which I'll give you a hint. The cameras on low-cost Windows phone are just as bad as the cameras on low-cost Android phones, in case you were wondering. That seems to be one of my major obsessions with camera reviews right now. How good, I should say camera reviews, phone reviews is how good is the camera. Yeah, I don't even know what to say.
That makes sense with, you know, how much, I mean, really, like that's a major part of the photo output on the internet is coming from phones. So. Really, it is, you know. Yeah.
No, I'm not arguing. Alan, thank you so much for filling in for Ryan this week. Ryan, of course, is indisposed this evening, I believe, preparing, meditating for the live session at PCPro.com.
Yeah. Something like that. It's going to be even more interesting because I'm going to be doing the video switching tomorrow.
Oh, a very special live broadcast from the PCPro studio.
Ken. Yes. I will be Ken. So the streaming system will be decked out with 32 terabytes worth of a RAID, and, you know, yeah.
I like that thought. Ladies and gentlemen, Alan Malventano, a.k.a. at Malventano on Twitter. I'm at Patrick Norton. Normally, we have at Ryan Shrout. You can always find those two guys at PCPer or PCPer.com. You can find me at TechZilla or DieTryin.com. And we want to thank you for joining us for this episode of Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware. And you can find all the episodes and all the information you need for subscribing to Twitch at twit.tv/Twitch, T-W-I-C-H. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Patrick Gorton.
I'm Alan Malventano.
See you next week on Twitch.